I'm Brandi Cruz. Coming up today on Undivided, some huge news out of Longview, Washington, where police have arrested the local public school superintendent for allegedly failing to report allegations of student sexual assault to the police. Plus, on the issue of schools, the GOP-controlled House of Representatives has passed a bill that would make it illegal for schools to secretly transition your child's gender. Plus, the Democratic Party seems genuinely incapable of actually diagnosing why they lost the 2024 election to Donald Trump. That and much more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, we're running our once yearly promo, 30% off an entire year of Undivided. That makes it like $3.50 a month to support the show. Go to patreon.com/undivided. That's patreon.com/undivided. Use the promo code USA30. Hello, hello, and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. Wow, a stunning story to start the show with today. It's developing as we speak. But here's what we know. There has been headlines out of the Longview, Washington School District for a few weeks now. There's even been protests out in that area over accusations that the school superintendent was covering up a student assault case. And people would be outside, parents basically saying, why are you being quiet about this? There had been multiple accusations about physical assaults involving students, even a sexual assault involving students. And essentially, the superintendent was being accused of playing it too close to the vest and trying to carry out her own sort of police investigation into what was going on. I suppose I didn't even fully understand the extent of it, but this news broke this morning. The Longview Public School Superintendent has been arrested. She faces multiple charges, including a felony charge associated with allegedly failing to report all of this to the police and interfering in the police investigation. Here's what the Longview Police Department put out today. They said on Thursday, May 21st, today at 9:30 in the morning, the Longview Police Department arrested Karen Klonginger, the superintendent of the Longview School District, as part of an ongoing investigation related to the reported sexual assault case involving students at Mark Morris High School. The charges include tampering with a witness, which is a felony, failure to report, which is a gross misdemeanor, and obstructing a law enforcement officer, also a gross misdemeanor. And that's not all. They say additional charges are forthcoming for Andrew Schoonover, the executive director of student services. And they're saying that he is going to be charged with failure to report and making a false or misleading statement to a public servant. This is wild. They say from the police chief in Longview, this investigation required a significant amount of time, coordination, and evidence review. We understand the significance this case has in our community and the concern it has created for students, families, staff, and the broader public. They say detectives developed their probable cause that Mark Morris High School staff and district leadership were made aware of allegations involving physical and sexual misconduct involving students as early as January of this year. Detectives allege that the superintendent, again, Karen Klonginger, was made aware of details involving multiple students, including allegations that one student was forcibly dragged into the Mark Morris High School varsity team room, pinned to the ground, and partially disrobed. They say that the Longview Police Department leadership, and this is all just insane, had been contacted by a parent about these assaults, but also that there were rumors and reports that began to circulate on social media and within the community. So the Longview Police Department sees these allegations and these reports, and they say they reached out to the school district to ask if it was something law enforcement needed to be involved in. Detectives allege that they were told the matter had been investigated by the Longview School District and was handled internally. Detectives also developed probable cause related to mandatory reporting requirements, information provided to law enforcement, and records and communications obtained through multiple search warrants. So they say that not only did this superintendent and who they're calling the executive director of student services, Andrew Schoonover, fail to report allegations of assault involving students as required by law, but that they also hindered the law enforcement investigation. I mean, she faces a felony, tampering with a witness charge. She also faces that obstructing law enforcement, and the other guy could be charged with making a false or misleading statement to a public official. Now, this is right in line with something we have been calling for on this show, which is the arrest and prosecution of school officials, administrators, and teachers who fail to report allegations of sexual misconduct or abuse as required under law. Because in the last few months, we have on this show broken multiple examples of that very thing. I think the most high-profile example is the Puyallup female wrestler who back in December told school officials that she was sexually assaulted by an opponent during a match, only to later find out the opponent was actually a biological male. It took the school months, not until we reached out to them months later, did they report it finally to the Pierce County Sheriff's Office. I said at the time, that's against the law. Why are the people, and it doesn't matter if you find it credible. There is no sort of asterisk in state law that says you must report this to police, but only if you do your own investigation first and find that there's credibility there. No, you just report it. I said that the individuals, the staff members, the teachers, the administrators in the Puyallup School District should have been arrested for failure to report because they even acknowledge that they knew about it. We had the emails. We documented all of it. And then more recently, our friend Alicia Perkins with OSD Rescue, she had a story very similar, sexual misconduct allegations in the Olympia School District, after there was an accusation from a student that was brought to a staffer that he was having a sexual relationship with someone at the school. And what did the assistant principals, Mallory Wilson and Elizabeth Cornelius, do? Well, they waited a few weeks to report those allegations to the police while they conducted their own ragtag investigation. And they ended up bungling the whole thing because someone in the school district they put in charge of looking at surveillance video to see if they could find any sort of evidence to corroborate the student's claims was, in fact, the staffer the student was allegedly having sex with. We said at the time, this was just a couple weeks ago, May 4th is when that story dropped, they should be arrested, or charged at least, with failure to report because they admitted to the police that they spent a few weeks investigating this on their own. That's against the law. So finally, we have a jurisdiction, the Longview Police Department, that is willing to actually say, if you fail in your duty under law to report allegations of abuse, sexual or otherwise, to law enforcement, we're going to arrest you for it. And if you impede our investigation, we're going to charge you for that too. Now, innocent until proven guilty. But again, these were issues that were already being raised in the community in Longview, and people were so concerned about it, they were protesting outside the school. Social media was abuzz with these allegations of what happened to this kid allegedly being dragged into the locker room and disrobed. That's how police find out on social media that there's something happening at Mark Morris High School that they should be investigating. And even when they call the school and say, hey, what's up with this? The school says, don't worry about it, according to the probable cause affidavit. So the state lawmaker who represents the Longview area happens to be Jim Walsh, the chair of the Washington State Republican Party. And keep in mind, all of this is happening at a time when there is a parental bill of rights that is going to be before voters in November. And part of it is strengthening the notification requirements for schools, at least with parents, but it's already a requirement under law to report stuff to the police. So I called Jim because I was flabbergasted by this morning, that this news came out. Again, she was just arrested at the time that we're doing this live show 3 hours ago. She's probably still in booking. And so I was like, oh my gosh, it finally happened. A police department finally is going to arrest one of these educators who allegedly keeps secrets from them. And so I called up Jim Walsh. I said, have you heard about this? What's going on? And he's like, yeah, this has been a huge thing in the community. So he was nice enough to pop on with us and tape an interview about what exactly is happening and sort of how this all plays into the larger conversation about parental rights and parental notification. Jim Walsh, I appreciate you hopping on with us. You know, you represent Longview. How significant of a story has this been for the community? I mean, even before this arrest was announced.
It's a story that's been sort of bubbling up for months. The community has been very concerned about it. It began as sort of a few allegations and has just grown and grown. And clearly there has been a systematic problem in the school district of abusive behavior on the part of students on students, on the part of some adults on students. And the pattern is the problem. It's been a thing that's been happening and growing. And I think this does connect to some of the broader kind of policy issues that we talk about on parental notification, parental rights, in that I believe the superintendent believes what she was doing was right. She believes she was managing a problem of the district in a way that was consistent with her values and the values that OSPI and Chris Reichtel articulate, that it's their job, it's the administrator's job to manage problems and deal with problems. It's not. No. She should have gone to the people, the parents, and the law enforcement authorities much sooner.
She's being charged with, and to that point, I mean, it is like a base, the failure to report, being a mandatory reporter is a very basic thing for a lot of different professions. If you're a law enforcement professional, if you're a teacher, if you're an educator, you have a duty to report under law. And so it's wild to me that you see this happening so often, but her charges include failure to report, obstructing a law enforcement officer, both misdemeanors, and tampering with a witness, which is a felony. Do you believe that that's commensurate with the crime?
As ever, Brandy, we need to be careful. We need to let the process work. But yes, these are serious allegations. And if the allegations hold up and there is substantial evidence that they are legitimate issues, then yes, this superintendent broke the law in serious ways. And I believe you will hear her defense of herself be, well, I was keeping it from the parents because it's my job to look after victims. It's my job to take care. No, it's not your job. If you have allegations of something like this happening, you should be notifying the parents, all parents in the district, but especially the parents of kids involved, immediately. Yeah. And then working with them, contact law enforcement and the proper authorities. And I believe, and I don't mean to make this too big of an issue, but the rhetoric that people like Senator Jamie Peterson use and the governor uses and OSPI Superintendent Reichtel use, tell these bureaucrats, these administrators, you're the parent. You're the one. They're your kids. You take after them. And that's not how it should be.
Yeah. And look, as I said, you know, we have an example of this with the girl who says she was sexually assaulted by a trans wrestler, took the district 2 months to report it to law enforcement. We just had a case in Olympia. I believe it was 2 weeks before they waited to report it to law enforcement. We've been wondering, why are they not charging these educators with failure to report? But to be clear, you know, while parental notification is going to be a key factor in the parental bill of rights that voters will vote on in November, this is already the law. You know, they Correct. Already legally cannot say, we're going to handle these investigations internally. So what, I guess, you know, I mean, even if the Parental Bill of Rights is passed by voters in November, what's going to stop this kind of conduct from continuing if they're already doing it when it's against the law?
Well, I mean, politics and law are often downstream of culture. And the cultural issue here is one of whose children are they? if a child is involved in something where he or she is hurt, is victimized, whose child is that? Who is the parent? Is the parent, or is the school district the parent? And I think we've created a culture where these education administrators think they are the parent. They believe the children are their children, not the parents' children. And that is a cultural problem that's bigger than law, bigger than public policy. We've got to fix that.
Yeah. It's
The
just
children
insane.
at school don't belong to the administrators. They don't.
Insane, you even have to ask that question. Who's the parent? I will say, though, I think a felony charge will be enough to set an example and show some of these school administrators, like, there might be consequences for you if you fail to report, if you tamper with a witness. I mean, a felony is significant. So hopefully, I would like to see this happen in some of the other cases that we have lingering out there. But I have to believe that that will make some people think twice.
And that's the reason this is a newsworthy story.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate what happened. We need to get justice for the kids who were hurt at the Longview School District. But this superintendent, she was mistaken. She thought she was the one who should decide how to handle this issue, and she should have been consulting with the parents, all parents, and with law enforcement much earlier in the process. It was not her judgment call to make how to handle this situation.
Yeah, she's not a police investigator. All right, Jim
Correct.
Walsh, we appreciate you updating us on this important story happening in your district, and I'm sure that this is only the beginning of it. So thank you so much for jumping on.
Good to talk to you.
Yeah, wild. So not too late to charge the other educators and school administrators who have done the exact same thing. By the letter of the law, they broke the law of their own admission. So there should be similar arrests in Puyallup. There should be similar arrests in Olympia. But I think politics factors into it. And I'm not saying Longview is a deep, deep red area and that the police made this based on a political decision at all, but maybe they're more willing to actually, I don't know, enforce the law there than, let's say, the city of Olympia. By Puyallup, I would hope so, that I mean, there's some sane people in the police department in Puyallup, and maybe it's a Pierce County issue, and there's definitely a willingness to prosecute crime in Pierce County. So where are the charges against the people who are not reporting things to law enforcement in our school districts as they should? This is wild. This is going to become a very significant story, I think, nationally. So we will obviously continue to monitor it. Meanwhile, we've got the Parental Rights Initiative up for a vote in November, and we've got Republicans in Congress who understand that parents have a right to know what's happening with their kids at school. What is stupid debate that we even have, that there would be anything that a school district could keep secret, anything, literally, that a school district could keep secret from parents, as if you get the parental rights as soon as they drop their kids off at the door. So the House just passed, with a few Democrats voting with them, passed a bill that it's H.R. 2616, Stopping Indoctrination and Protecting Kids Act. So it makes it illegal, basically, to secretly transition your child at a school. And that's happening so much in Washington State, even if it's a dozen instances that we've reported on. That's way too many, where you've got a kid that goes to school, and all of a sudden at school, they call him by a different name and a different gender, and the school doesn't tell the parents. And so the child's like living a double life. They're Johnny at home and Julie at school or whatever it is. How crazy is that we're even having this conversation? So that passed in the House. I would hope it would have enough votes to pass in the Senate, because you even had Marie Glusenkamp Perez from Washington's 3rd congressional district. She voted with this, with Democrat or with Republicans on this. So every Republican in the Senate should support this. And we'll have to see, what it means for states that do have a secretive policy around, like Washington, around gender ideology, and how that the federal law would translate to the states. But one of the mechanisms that they use is federal funding. So it would require parental consent before, like, a school can officially update a child's pronouns or preferred name, and that would be in order to receive federal funding. So I guess you could have our state say, like, screw you, because the feds have threatened to withhold federal funding over a lot of things, and I'm not sure if they've succeeded in the courts. But knowing what the law does, look at the Washington State Standard headline. U.S. House passes sweeping gender ideology bill aimed at trans kids in schools. It's always got to be that negative connotation. You could say trans bill aimed at helping parental rights, solidifying parental rights. No, it's always about aimed at trans kids. They write, the measure, which succeeded 217 to 198, would also bar federal funding under the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965 that provides federal aid to schools from being used, quote, to teach or advance concepts related to gender ideology. So, yeah, I mean, I really don't think that there should be discussion about radical gender ideology in schools at all. I don't see a useful educational function for that. That's something that parents should be able to handle. And look, if a parent wants to send their kid to school and wants their kid to be called Julie instead of Johnny, I mean, that's a conversation, I guess, for the parent to have with the school district, but you don't cut them out. I mean, they wouldn't in our state with some of these like very ideological schools. If you had a parent that was like very supportive of their child's gender ideology and wanted them to transition and be all these things, oh, the school would be calling them every day. Oh, here's an update on how Julie's doing or whatever it is. They just want to cut out. The only parents they want to cut out are the parents who don't align with them, who are like religious, who are conservative, whatever it is. Those are the parents they think they are not fit to raise their own kids. So we're going to raise their kids. So Congress is doing it. Some Democrats even. And Marie Glusenkamp Perez, I know she's trying to walk a line because she's very vulnerable in the third. But if you support that bill, then surely we should be getting support publicly from you, hearing about it on the Let's Go Washington initiative to restore parental rights, right? We'll follow up with her office. So surely she supports the Let's Go Washington initiative to restore parental rights if she supports this bill and voted for it in Congress. All right. The Democratic Party, I've been saying this for a long time, totally incapable of actually being introspective about why they keep losing to Donald Trump. And there is this new report out from the DNC that looks at why they lost the 2024 election, also mentions Washington Governor Bob Ferguson, just stunningly void of anything meaningful. We'll discuss. First, if you're a small to mid-sized landlord in the state of Washington, consider becoming a member of the Rental Housing Association of Washington. They can help you on a one-on-one basis. If you've got one rental unit, 5, 10, you're just having trouble keeping up to date with all the changing rules and regulations in the state, the county level and the local level, they can help you with that. Make sure you have the right screening tools and forms. And then they are fighting on your behalf all year long. They've got a really important property rights case that's weaving its way through the system that could be pretty important from a precedent perspective. And then they're down in Olympia advocating on your behalf as well. So if you're a landlord, it's like $260 a year to join the RHA, and I think it's worth it. They've got a ton of informative events as well. Washington's trusted resource empowering housing providers, rhawa.org, rhawa.org. You probably will see this all over social media today. And I kind of want to take maybe a different angle on it than I'm seeing a lot of commentators taking from CNN. Read the DNC's 2024 autopsy obtained by CNN. It says CNN is publishing a copy of a report into why Democrats lost the 2024 presidential election, and it was conducted at the request of DNC Committee Chair Ken Martin. They say the version of this report, better known as the 2024 autopsy, was written by Democratic strategist Paul Rivera. The DNC withheld the report until presented with CNN's reporting about its contents. So basically, CNN reported on the existence of this autopsy, with it, which is like several hundred pages, done by this Democratic strategist that allegedly was supposed to look into a deep dive in why did Democrats lose to Donald Trump in 2024. So the DNC hadn't released it publicly, but then after CNN talked about it, they gave CNN a copy, although they marked it up with all these like disagreements they made with the strategist, which I thought was kind of weird. It's like, you guys hired him, but you're writing all these things like that's not true in the report anyway. So CNN is publishing it because the DNC wants them to publish it. And in fact, the DNC chair gave this quote to CNN. When I was elected DNC chair, I commissioned an after-action review of the 2024 election that I wanted to be honest and transparent and with actionable and specific takeaways for the future of the Democratic Party. When I received the report late last year, it wasn't ready for prime time, not even close. And because no source material was provided, it would have meant starting over. I could not in good faith put the DNC stamp of approval on the report that was produced. I mean, probably because you just didn't like the report. I don't know. It says, after last November's massive Democratic wins, I didn't want to create a distraction, but by not putting the report out, I ended up creating an even bigger distraction. Blah, 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 blah. So they obviously have a motivation for wanting to publish the report with all their little notations on it. But I've got to say, when I hear that you did a several hundred page autopsy of why your party lost the 2024 election, I guess I expected there to be something of substance in there, really at all, but something of substance around the policy reasons you lost. Like, what policy positions did Americans prefer of Donald Trump's and not of Democrats? There's nothing. Nothing. I did a search through the whole thing for a couple keywords: immigration, border, gender, trans, some of these high profile issues. They didn't mention at all how bad their handling of the border was under Biden. Nothing about it. How bad their immigration policy was, how out of hand it got. They didn't mention anything about, like, maybe they handled COVID badly when people were still upset about it, or the race and social justice issue, like the riots. No, nothing on, like, hey, maybe we should stop pretending boys are girls. Nothing. This entire report was basically, and they even mentioned Trump more than Kamala Harris and more than Biden. The entire report was essentially like a blame game thing. How we can kind of manipulate voters better, right? And then it was about, oh, Kamala Harris wasn't prepared for primetime. We should have done more to help Kamala Harris. And don't get me wrong, Kamala was a horrible candidate. And she obviously was very ill-prepared to run for president. And she was just sort of forced into it. But the obvious things to me are, wow, you guys let like an invasion at our southern border happen. They don't want to talk about policy at all. So if you can't fix that, you're not going to be able to fix your party. So a couple takeaways. At the beginning, they blame misinformation and disinformation. So again, it's not about us. It's not about, it says, our party and our candidates have lost the confidence and trust of voters. In the face of misinformation and disinformation, our candidates have proven incapable of projecting strength, unity, and leadership, and voters have drifted away. Yeah, that's not why someone like me, who despised Donald Trump, finally voted for Donald Trump in 2004, because of misinformation and disinformation. So you're essentially saying voters are stupid, they fall for the misinformation and disinformation, and we just need to project strength and leadership, and they won't drift away from us. So I thought that was just crazy. Now, here is maybe one of the only takeaways that I thought like was even somewhat coherent. So the report says, prior to the midterm election, the White House directed the DNC to conduct polling to identify how Dr. Jill Biden could support her husband as president. However, no similar research was conducted to support the vice president, to identify the issues she should talk about, the ways in which she should talk about them, the audiences with which she could perhaps resonate and support the president's agenda. So they did more research, the DNC did, trying to figure out how Jill Biden could be an effective messenger for the Biden administration than they did how Kamala Harris could be an effective messenger for the Biden administration. And then they said this, and again, I agree with this. It says, the White House did not position or prepare the vice president. Had the White House explored and evaluated ways to leverage Kamala Harris earlier in the administration, perhaps it would have improved the president's standing, and it certainly could have helped prepare her to lead the ticket. Any fair critic of the vice president has to acknowledge the strength and ability she demonstrated as the nominee. The idea that a prepared and supported vice president could not have helped the president in the preceding 3.5 years is a significant failure of imagination. And I agree with that, but it's not really the failure of the DNC or the Democrats to like give her something productive to do. It was that she like could hardly string a sentence together. She wasn't a good messenger because she doesn't know how to deliver a message. And maybe you could have helped with that. But this is the thing, hundreds of pages of this that they were focused on. How could we, from a political strategy perspective, have done better rather than, I don't know, just have better ideas that the American people actually want, like things they want fixed, the southern border, stop calling me a bigot if I don't think boys are girls, any number of things. They don't mention any of that at all. Now, one thing I thought was interesting is they did mention Washington's gubernatorial race in this. And this was one of those these things where they say there was no evidence provided to back this up. But it is true that Ferguson underperformed, as it says, Ferguson underperformed Harris in Democratic strongholds. But overall, you know, Bob Ferguson got 55% of the vote in Washington. Kamala Harris got 57% of the vote. And part of that is because Dave Reichert outperformed Donald Trump. So sort of the moderates tended to skew toward Dave Reichert in a way that they didn't tend to skew toward Donald Trump. But it had this takeaway that I actually thought was pretty good. The lesson, even in safe blue states, lower profile races need affirmative cases for candidates, not just opposition to Trump. So, I mean, that's what Ferguson ran his campaign on. Oh, I just hate Trump. And even the DNC strategist is like, yeah, you know, even when it's a safe race, we probably should make sure that they have some sort of like policy platform to run on, and they need to make an affirmative case for themselves. And that means not just saying Trump bad. You got to say why you're good. I'm good. Not just Trump bad. But it's just fascinating to me. They continue their obsession with Donald Trump. They think that Donald Trump won because we're all just a bunch of misinformed, misinformation, disinformation enthusiasts. And they have no interest in improving their party's policy positions. That's not an autopsy. It's like 200 pages of whining. And the low-hanging fruit is the border. They mentioned one thing about the border, about how Joe Biden made Kamala Harris this border czar, but like didn't prepare her for the gravity of that job. So it just made her look ridiculous, which is true, but your whole party isn't prepared for the gravity of that job. So it just continues to stun me. 10 years just trying to get rid of Donald Trump by any means necessary, except improving your own party platform. That's a step too far. We'll try to impeach him multiple times. We'll try to put him in prison. We'll try to kill him. But we won't take the much simpler step and much more legal step of just trying to become a better party that more Americans want to vote for. All right. More money needed in Seattle. More money, more money, more money. The city's worse and worse off, and all they want is more money from people. I mean, we talked about, what was it, $400 million they want voters in Seattle to cough up for a library levy. And now they want $1.5 billion, roughly, to fix up Seattle Center. Okay. So in the King 5 article, which had no mention of what it would cost, King 5's just like, Seattle leaders are pushing to revitalize Seattle Center ahead of a possible Supersonics return. It says Mayor Katie Wilson and Councilmember Rob Sacca are pushing to secure funding to restore and revitalize the iconic campus ahead of a possible 2027 bond measure. Sacca has described the area as dated and crumbling fast. This stuff bothers me so much because money will not fix why people aren't going to the Seattle Center. Just like money won't fix like what's happened to downtown and your key tourist areas. Seattle Center would be fine. It would have been maintained and wonderful and beautiful if people wanted to visit Seattle. But our tourism has really struggled because you've struggled to keep it a nice, pleasant place for people to be. And you let people set up tents at Seattle Center. I don't know if it's still there, but by the Mopop, is that what it's called? Mm-hmm. There was like a tent encampment. So yeah, I mean, it's a little outdated in places, but it doesn't help that you have tent encampments and drug addicts hanging around. So for hell, we could give you $20 billion. If you're not willing to enforce the laws on the books to make it a safe, pleasant place for families to bring their kids, then it doesn't matter how nice it looks. I mean, the downtown mall in Seattle is a perfect example. Pacific Place, they did a multi-million dollar renovation on that thing. There's hardly a store in it. You could go in there on the weekday or even a Friday. There's nobody in there shopping. It's the lipstick on a pig theory. At least the Center Square says how much it would cost. In their headline, plan to renovate Seattle Center could require $1.5 billion. Seattle property owners would be asked to foot that bill for some renovations. And I get it. The Sonics coming back. Yeah, that place needs to look better. But like, look, if the Sonics are back and they're having people, I'm sure that the ownership team, you could get private dollars to make all of that shine, because they're going to want people to come there and enjoy the Seattle Center.
Advertising.
Advertising, whatever it is.
Anything. Again, to taxpayers for property tax increase. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's absolutely insane. So it needs to be livened up, right? And the Kraken, and the stadium's beautiful. The stadium is absolutely a world-class stadium. And I hate the name, but, you know, Amazon did a great job with it. And Amazon has the money to help clean up. Maybe you should be nicer to Amazon.
I was going to say.
Maybe you should be nicer to Starbucks.
You want all this money, but you're telling millionaires, see ya.
Right, exactly. It's just insane. So, no, let's enforce the law so it's a nice place to be. And then you'll have people start to open shops back up in the whatever you call it, that big building there with all the restaurants and stuff. And it'll look better and everything will be wonderful. And that will fix itself. You don't need money for it. All right, we'll do a double dose of Unbelievable coming up next. First, Undivided viewer Lon Westover decided pretty quick he wanted to leave Washington State for Arizona, needed to sell his house here, was a little worried that there was some cosmetic upgrades he'd need to do. He reached out to Wes Jones of sellwithwes.com. Wes said, yeah, we need to do a few things before you sell your home. Lon and his wife were hesitant, but they did what Wes said, and they were so happy with the results.
So we ended up doing pretty much everything they said. We did it all, and then all of a sudden, in 5 days, it was three offers, all above list price. It was just kind of stunned. So yeah. It was dramatic, unbelievable thing. Because I told Wes when we talked to him, I said, well, we had to eat crow on it. He goes, well, Lon, you followed the process. That's all I ask you to do. You followed it. Well, thank you for pushing us through, pushing us over the edge to make the process work.
Yeah, so he went from Sell with Wes to Sold with Wes. Now he's down in Arizona just loving life. And sometimes, especially in a market where you've got a lot of saturation of listings, which is happening right now because people are fleeing the state, you do have to make your house shine. And Wes knows exactly what to do, what's going to be worth it on the front end to make sure you get your money back on it. So just reach out to him and get some advice from him and get a free market analysis so he can kind of give you a lay of the land. Sellwithwes.com, sellwithwes.com. It really just is a better way to sell your home. Let's get to a double edition of Unbelievable. The solution for progressives is always, if we spend more money on this, it'll get better. If we spend more money on this, we'll have better outcomes. Not like, hey, how can we address the root of this issue? We just talked about it with Seattle Center. It's like, hey, there's more reasons than just a crumbling facade that people aren't coming to Seattle Center. This next story, I think, is in a similar vein. KUOW published this headline, "Law doesn't do enough to help undocumented kids in foster care," lawsuit says. So there is a class action lawsuit that basically says that Washington's Department of Children, Youth, and Families isn't helping enough to identify and assist immigrant youth who may be eligible for legal status. The lawsuit estimates that more than 100 undocumented youth in the state may qualify for additional help. They talk about one girl from Guatemala who's now 18 years old and finishing high school. She entered the U.S. alone in 2023 without a legal guardian. Another girl, also from Guatemala, now 17, also came to the U.S. alone to look for her mother. Both teens are now in the custody of Washington's foster care system. And they say in a lawsuit that the state has failed to provide adequate immigration support to help them avoid the risk of deportation. What? Why is that our job? Literally, why is that our state's responsibility? It's like you came across the border. You weren't even that young. Alone, from Guatemala. And of course, they come straight to a state where they know there's the most handouts and where they're going to be safe. And then that's not even enough for them. Now they're like, you know, and it's probably some activists who encourage them to sue. And now they're saying, you don't do enough for us. Now, you're paying for my existence and foster care and all of these things, but you're not doing enough to help. And I don't think it was driven by these teens. I think it's driven by immigrant rights groups who just want more money from state taxpayers shoveled into their NGOs and their nonprofits and all of these things. And I've said, you know, I think dreamers at this point should just get citizenship, but then cut it off and that program's over after that, because you don't want to give people an incentive to come into the country. But, you know, if you keep giving teens, you know, all of the access to all of these things, housing, food, school, all these things paid for, they're going to continue to come here from Guatemala. And some of them go through horrific things trying to get here. And so you're okay with them going through that? Because as long as that's the policy of Washington State, they're going to keep trying to come here, right? So you are basically giving them a reason to make these like 1,000-mile treks with, you know, mules, put their life in danger, because you're saying, yeah, come on in. We want to have you here. We'll do all these things for you. It's just absolutely wild. So it says, one of the people mentioned in here is the exec director for legal counsel for youth and families. It says, undocumented children in foster care can apply for what's called a special immigrant juvenile classification, which is available to youth who have been abused, abandoned, or neglected by a parent. If granted, the youth may later qualify for lawful permanent residency. According to Rhea Yeo, the executive director for legal counsel for youth and families, Washington State, even though they hold themselves out to be pro-immigrant, significantly lags behind other states who already have policies, practices, and procedures to provide more proactive legal help for unaccompanied immigrant minors. So again, one of the most welcoming states in the nation for illegal aliens. And these groups say you don't do enough. You don't do enough. How about they just don't come here to begin with? Like, that's what we should be looking at, is if we're actual leaders, how do we slow the tide of illegal of minors fleeing their home country to begin with and coming here illegally? Because that's just a dangerous situation for them. Now, Trump has done that, right, by slowing the flow of illegal immigration to almost nothing across the southern border. And in doing so, he's protecting tens of thousands of children from being trafficked, from going on these long journeys across difficult terrain, from being caught up in with drug cartel. That is the most sympathetic. That is the safest way, from a policy position, to deal with these kids. Not to let them go through all of that and come here and then have them be on the taxpayer teat for the rest of their lives. Outrageous. All right, Governor Inslee, rules for thee, but not for me. Let's get to it in our second edition of Unbelievable. Right. The U.S. House of Representatives is considering a bill that would add at the federal level, a $130 annual EV fee to pay for road repairs. So this is, again, federal level, basically saying, you know, because you have a federal gas tax, right, which is part of the price you pay at the pump. So if you got an EV, you aren't contributing to the federal gas tax. So we've got to hit you with a $130 per year EV fee. From Reuters, it says the House is working on a 5-year highway reauthorization bill that would authorize $580 billion ahead of the current law expiring in September. Most revenue for federally funded road repairs is collected through diesel and gas taxes, which EVs don't pay. The law would require the fees to be hiked by $5 per year starting in 2029 up to a total of $150. The U.S. Transportation and Infrastructure Committee is expected to take up the bill on Thursday. So today, and it was introduced by the Republican chair, Sam Graves, and Rick Larson of our state. So it's a bipartisan bill. Republicans and Democrats saying, let's add a $130 EV fee, have it increase by increments of five until it gets to $150. Well, this is interesting because Jay Inslee, the former governor of Washington and the king of EVs, thinks this is a horrible idea. Totally backward. He says the House highway bill is completely backward. It makes no sense to put new fees on EVs and cut funding for transit when Americans are paying more for gas and energy thanks to Trump's disastrous policies, while big oil pockets billions in taxpayer-funded subsidies. You know what's interesting about that? Jay Inslee put fees on EVs when he was the governor. He did the same thing. So the electric vehicle EV fee passed into law under Governor Inslee, owner of all electric and plug-in hybrid vehicles, except motorcycles, with an all-electric range of at least 30 miles, must pay an annual registration fee of $150 and a $75 transportation electrification fee in addition to standard vehicle fees. So he's... because it's happening under the Trump administration? I mean, I don't even know what What is his complaint here? He did the exact same thing in Washington state. Not to mention that Democrats are probably going to, in the next couple years, implement a pay per mile fee so they can also cash in on EVs in that way. So it's a bipartisan bill at the federal level, compensates for the fact that you have these EVs driving on our roads, but they're not paying the same money that other vehicle owners are paying at the gas pump. So we need to try to compensate in some form or fashion, which I don't necessarily disagree with. But you can't support it when you do it, Jay Inslee, and oppose it when the feds do it. That makes absolutely no sense. But he never does. He never makes any sense. All right, coming up next, Jeff Bezos has an idea on income taxes and who should be paying federal income taxes and who should not. First, happening today at 3:30 p.m., our friend Zach Abraham with Bulwark Capital is going to be having one of his Know Your Risk live webinars. You can still sign up. It's totally free to do that. It's called his Impact of Energy live webinar. He's going to explain how every market is driven by energy. He's going to talk about the impact energy has on inflation and how that could potentially affect your retirement planning. Plus, he'll do a full reveal of how Bulwark is focused on risk management, always looking for opportunities to lower risk, lower cost, give your retirement as much upside as possible. So join Zach's Impact of Energy webinar happening today, 3:30 p.m. Pacific time. And you can also, if you go to knowyourriskpodcast.com, subscribe to Zach's daily podcast, find out where to follow him on social media, etc. knowyourriskpodcast.com. All right. And Nicole, do you have this clip from Jeff Bezos? Yes. Okay. So Jeff Bezos did an interview with CNBC, and there were a lot of takeaways, I think. But he was talking about the fact that he thinks the bottom half of income earners in America, so generally considered to be people as a household making under $54,000, $55,000 a year, he says that they shouldn't pay any federal income tax.
We can give them a better chance by eliminating their tax bill. I don't want to reduce it. I want to eliminate it. I think there's something very powerful about zero. You know, like zero is a better number than like $1. You know, we don't charge, we have free shipping at Amazon, not like 25 cents shipping. Zero is a good number. When people are starting out and they're struggling, right, stop taxing them.
Now, I agree with the notion that I think everyone should be taxed less. You know, when people are like, tax the rich, it's not that I don't want the rich taxed, I just want everyone to be taxed less. And, you know, I had a conversation with Zach Abraham about this. Is it a good idea? And he pointed out that it's like accounts for maybe 3% of the money the federal government's getting in as the taxes paid by households making under $54,000 a year. So, I mean, if you could alleviate that for them and also just have to cut spending by 3%, to me, that seems like a no-brainer. I asked you guys in our daily subscriber show poll, do you believe American households making less than $55,000 should be exempt from the federal income tax? Nicole, yes. And I think the way they'd have to structure this, just so everybody understands, is it would be like a $55,000 exemption.
Right.
And then what you make after that. So technically, if you make like $100,000, the first $55,000 you don't pay a federal income tax on. So even if you make more than $55,000, your taxes would still go down a little bit as a result of this.
I like it because it's not that you're not paying any taxes. You're still paying sales tax. I mean, like there's all sorts of taxes we pay. So I think that that's a fair incentive to get people going in life, because you're starting out, you're trying to get things going in your life, you're trying to make more, and this is a good incentive for, hey, like this gives you a little extra boost to get there.
My only criticism or concern, because I'm inclined to say yes, my only concern is that what about the people who are just coasting off the taxpayer and they're not bringing in much, they don't want to contribute, they're getting, you know, this kind of gives them a free, how do you differentiate between somebody working hard and somebody who's not?
Well, because it's not so much money that you're like, I'm not going to work because I don't have to pay, you know, a couple thousand in income tax. So it's not enough money to make you comfortable living off of that extra, you know, couple grand you have a year.
Yeah.
I think that it's, you know, if you would like to better your situation, you're going to try to better your situation. Yeah. I don't think this is going to have you, you know, I don't know, sitting by a pool every day drinking.
It definitely would have helped me when I first came to Seattle and was making no money, and not to have that tax would have been pretty significant.
Just to be able to put that away, maybe to save for a house, things like that.
Yeah. So 27% of you say yes, But most of you are opposed to the idea of giving that federal income tax break. 73-ish percent say no. Joe Sixpack says every American needs to have skin in the game, even if it's only $10. Kevin Gaylord responded to that right on the nail. Don't care how much, just need everyone to kick something in to reduce the what do I care? It doesn't cost me anything.
But they are with gas taxes, things like
yeah.
that. But
yeah, there's something that they're given.
That's my kind of reasoning.
Yeah. Son says, at the risk of sounding like a liberal, we all need to pay our fair share. yeah. E, absolutely. And abolish property tax for everyone as well. Should be a federal law that supersedes all state laws. No income tax, no property tax for anyone. The government has a spending problem, both local and federal, and we need a smaller government, not a bigger one. Yeah, I mean, fundamentally, they don't need as much tax money as they're getting. Right. I'm in favor of a flat tax. I think a 10% flat tax on all Americans at the federal level, a 3% state income tax-ish, maybe even 2% on all Americans, and all other taxes are abolished. And make it flat and get rid of the workarounds. Get rid of the workarounds that people use to alleviate their tax burden. There's no write-offs. There's nothing like that. It's just everyone pays 10% of the federal, 3% of the state. And then it's consistent. It's not confusing. And it's more than enough to fund the federal government and the states.
And that's how much money you have.
Right.
You don't get no more.
Exactly. And then you have do with it.
Yes.
Spend it wisely. Yes.
Or don't spend.
Yes. All right. It is Thursday. That's when we go to Florida and check in on what's happening in the Sunshine State with my sister Miranda. It's our segment, Florida Report.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
Miranda, hello.
Hello.
It happened. The U.S. has indicted Raul Castro, of course, the Cuban dictator. What's the mood like in Miami, where you are, where there are plenty of Cubans who fled Castro?
I think there's a lot of excitement and just waiting on pins and needles for what comes next. A lot of emotion, too, because I think people have just been really hoping that the government would do something realistic towards the regime in Cuba. And this is the first thing that's happened in a long time that I think gives them hope that this, you know, in the coming future, maybe even this year, Cuba's going to see a huge change, maybe even some freedom.
Yeah. What? I mean, you can't just say you're a communist and I don't like it, so we're going to indict you as a foreign government. So what is the accusation in the indictment?
Yeah, so these charges are coming from an event that happened back in 1996 when he was the defense minister for Cuba. Basically, two unarmed civilian planes that were delivering humanitarian aid that came from Miami were gunned down over Cuba. So him, along with five others, have been indicted on federal murder charges, conspiracy to kill U.S. nationals, and destruction of an aircraft because three of the people that were on board those aircrafts were U.S. citizens. Mm.
They're going to go snatch this guy up, aren't they? They're going to snatch him like they did Maduro.
I think so, too. He's 94 years old. So, you know, he faces life in prison, of course. But this is definitely, I think, a little more tactical to put pressure on Cuba or give them a way in to, like you said, maybe snatch him like they did Maduro and, you know, open the can of worms that's inevitably coming when it comes to Cuba.
Yeah, here's the Attorney General of the state of Florida talking about this and just generally kind of the horrible things that go hand in hand with communism.
Communist revolution always begins with the same utopian lie, a classless, stateless paradise of abundance and freedom. But we know the reality. We've seen what communism has brought us. Over 100 million people that have lost their lives, engineered famines, and the total destruction of human liberty. Just 90 miles from our Florida shorelines, the Castro family has ruled the island with an iron fist. For nearly 50 years, Raul Castro directed the armed forces and served as chief enforcer. The very man who traded the promise of revolution for a prison state. And under his command and to this day, Cuba remains a dungeon.
Oh, let's hope he, you know, he made it a prison state. Let's hope his final resting place on this earth is in a United States prison. I will also just say, though, a little bit different than like going in and, you know, killing the Ayatollah of Iran, because how close is Cuba to Miami? What, 90 miles?
90 miles from Key West, a little farther to Miami, but from American soil, only 90 miles.
Yeah, and there have reportedly been, and I don't know if this is like from legitimate intelligence sources, but a concern that maybe they'd go, you know, Iranians, for instance, use these drones to carry out attacks, and a drone could definitely get that far. So what's the actual concern that if you go in and try to snatch up Castro as the United States, that they'd, you know, are they worried in Key West that they might bomb them with drones?
Yeah, so I think the implication is that Cuba has been trying to get their hands and maybe already has on attack drones similar to what Iran's used. And basically, there is no intelligence that's made public that this was a threat being made. But when Axios, who put out the initial report, reached out to the Cuban embassy for comment, they didn't respond, but they did put on their Twitter page or their X page that they have a right to self-defense, to defend themselves. And I think with the escalating tensions and, you know, with what just happened yesterday with the indictment of Castro, I don't think that it's a far-fetched idea to be, you know, to keep the eyes on yeah. you know, keep your eyes on the border and make sure that everybody's kind of like ready in case something does happen.
Yeah. And I'm sure the U.S. government knows, has a plan for that, right? You don't do something like this, and especially if they're going to carry it out by going and arresting him without being very aware of what the response might be. All right. There was a Real America's Voice had a reporter out with ICE agents in Florida. And of course, Florida police are mandated to cooperate with ICE. And so it's a much, much better working relationship there. But he's like out as they're arresting an illegal. And then something happens with another illegal. Here's the video.
That's not good. Crazy scene here, day two of the operation. We're over here picking up one illegal driving this van, and then this ends up happening. This driver slammed on his brakes. This guy hits him, but then this guy just happens to be illegal too. The density of the population of illegals in America, most Americans just can't comprehend it. I mean, literally, we're picking up this guy. This guy's an illegal driving, gets rear-ended by this guy who's just on his way to work. Crazy. Moral of the story is, don't come into America illegally. Don't drive without a license or insurance. You only have yourself to blame. If you're in this country illegally, don't blame ICE, blame yourself.
In Washington state, that wouldn't happen because, you know, first of all, our state police wouldn't be out assisting ICE. And then if they went and checked on the accident, they don't know. The system literally won't tell them and they won't look whether someone's in the country illegally. So, but in Florida, yeah, you're going to have to stay clean because they'll deport you.
Yeah. And this guy, I did read that the guy that got rear-ended, he was the other illegal. He didn't have a driver's license, didn't have insurance. So already it's one of the reasons our car insurance down here is probably pretty expensive in situations like that.
Yeah. One more thing I want to have you weigh in on. We actually ended the show with it on Monday in Sanity Check. So Byron Donalds, who's probably going to be the next governor of Florida, is that probably the case?
Yeah, that seems to be the consensus. Yeah. He does have most support, I think.
Yeah, he's got Trump's endorsement. So he was asked about, you know, all this wealth fleeing and businesses fleeing from blue states to Florida. Here's what he said.
Have you noticed the influx of wealth in Florida?
Oh, absolutely. You travel this state, you're seeing people from New York, from California, from Illinois, starting to get some from Washington State, because Washington State is telling the other blue states, hold my beer, we'll tell you how to really get crazy.
Wow.
And you're starting to see it come from everywhere.
Yeah, hold my beer. Now, good for you guys. But, you know, having wealth and businesses and entrepreneurs flood into your state is definitely going to have some of the same impacts it had for us. I mean, housing prices through the roof, cost of living through the roof. Is that something that you're hearing anyone even talk about or plan for?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I do work a lot in the real estate industry, so my business will benefit greatly from that. But at the end of the day, it is already very costly to live in Florida in general, especially in Miami. You do have a lot of these big businesses coming to set up shop here in South Florida, in Miami. And it does bring wealthier people, which comes with that, just the inflation in general that comes with wealthier people. I hope that the businesses bring jobs that people in Florida, locals, can qualify for. And then it's not just bringing more people in to just work from other states, you know. So it'll be interesting to see how it all plays out when the dust settles. I mean, it is exciting, but there is a reality of people who live here that just are really getting priced out.
So. Yeah. I mean, you went through it with trying to buy your first house. It was like, holy smokes. I mean, the price for your first house, very similar to what it would be for the price for, you know, a starter home in Seattle or something. Maybe not quite there yet, but getting there. So, all right, Miranda, it's the good and the bad. Okay, we'll talk to you later.
Bye.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
When they're out of office, we're going to have to redo that graphic at some point sooner for Ron DeSantis, because he's going to be out of office before President Trump is. So we'll have to replace it. All right, let's get to some subscriber and other comments. Longview school superintendent being arrested. Lachman, you too, says you want to join us, Nicole? Okay. Guess where we're going today? Well, I'm not going to say exactly where, because, you know, I don't know who's following.
Well, I know where. I don't
know. We're going to go see Old Sub Sailor.
Yeah.
Our friend Old Sub Sailor. We're going to take a ferry to go see him after the show today. One of our frequent commenters and supporters. He was one of the winners of our Constitution auction.
Right.
To benefit We Heart Seattle. So we're going to go. We're going to have some pizza, chat about things. We'll see you then.
Right.
I'm excited, too. It's a nice day to take a ferry, and I haven't been on a ferry in quite a while. So, see, you could go from commenter to dinner guest just like that. Only cost you $3,500 to buy a Constitution for charity. Lachman, you too. Every school superintendent should be put on notice because of what is going on here. There's probably a lot more going on in public schools than what we know about. I do think this will have a huge effect, because if you can get charged with like a felony crime and it's happened, that would do it for me if I had any inclination to keep a case from law enforcement.
Yeah, you can only hope and pray it has that kind of effect. Yeah. But this does seem, I mean, she lied.
Well, they're saying that she interfered with the investigation. So it's not just because the failure to report is a gross misdemeanor.
Right.
But she's got hit with a felony.
Right.
It'll be interesting to see how OSPI responds.
Yeah.
And how the teachers' union responds, although the superintendent wouldn't be a member of the teachers' union. But Greg said, now only if she's prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. We know cops want to do their jobs, but judges, on the other hand.
That's true.
Yeah. Yep. But a felony's a felony. Lynn Julin, regarding the Longview school superintendent, I would love to have a records request done on OSPI's Rakedahl to see if he knew as well. On any of the failures to notify police, and if he failed to report it, that would give opportunity to have him further investigated. Yeah, I mean, anyone who knew before police knew, who has a duty to report under the law, that would be a failure to report. But I doubt that she contacted OSPI. Yeah, but worth looking into.
Possibly, but yeah, if you have to submit a complaint, so that would be the way that the parents or whoever would have to. You'd have to submit like a complaint or whatever. But
yeah, it's a complicated process. Mm-hmm. Just tell the cops.
Yeah.
Angry Archer Outdoors. It's great to see law enforcement doing their job as they're supposed to. I know. Huge credit to Longview Police Department. It seems like they put a lot of work into the case as well and were met with resistance every step of the way. Mm-hmm. On Democrats, they just can't get it together. Just try. You know, the other thing they didn't even mention, in this autopsy of the 2024 election, didn't mention Biden's debate performance or Biden's declining mental state, which was a huge issue.
Maybe it's implied better candidate.
Yeah. Didn't mention
coherent.
The fact that Kamala was just installed in undemocratic process and that could have turned voters off as well. They didn't talk about anything of substance, like hundreds of pages. How much did you pay guy for that report? I could have put together a better report.
Is that because they knew people would see it and they didn't want to admit all those faults? I feel like that's what it's about.
Possibly.
Because I know people will see these things and they're like, don't put in what we actually did wrong. Because we know those things. Don't worry about it.
I don't know. Funny. It's wild. Big Princess says the DNC isn't serious about fixing their political platforms. Necro Two Shoes, that's because they don't want the report to be used against them for the next thing Trump does that they used to support, but no longer do because of Trump. On Katie needing $1.5 billion to fix up Seattle Center, Chris says, employ the unhoused folks hanging out in Seattle to clean up Seattle Center. It'll create jobs and make it cheaper.
I mean, it would be cool if that place was cleaned up and that it used to be a big carnival, remember?
Yeah.
And I think that would be cool, but you can't shoo people out of the city and then say, oh, but everybody that sticks around, you pay a whole bunch to fix all this stuff up and make it look better.
No. You got to make it safe for people to go out. No encampments. If you want it to be a tourist spot, there can't be a homeless encampment there.
Is this
the controversial stuff? Mm-hmm. Like, literally, if you want it to be a tourist spot, you can't have a homeless encampment there.
Needles on the ground.
Right-wing extremism talking points. On KUOW article criticizing the treatment of young illegals, Joanne says, I've never gotten 1 ounce of help from the state of Washington. I was born and I've been here for 71 years. I have a real problem with helping illegal immigrants. Yes. Like, you're 71 years old. You paid taxes here for not seven decades. You probably didn't pay taxes until you were, in your teens. But let's say 50 years. You're not getting anything from the federal government besides, the basics, public safety, roads, all these things, or from the state government. I mean, they're talking about illegals. And then on the show yesterday, we discussed they want to give trans refugees housing, food, legal assistance. It's like, how many people who are citizens of this state and have been for 70 years could use help with their housing costs and buying food, and they're not asking for it?
And I just really don't believe it's to help the people that are actually here. They want to bring people in for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Like in both of those cases, I think they have different reasons. But as far as this lawsuit goes, I think they have one kid that's kind of signed on to it, who's like aging out. But they just want, you can claim neglect or not neglect, but abandonment or whatever. Right. And then all of a sudden you're given citizenship. That's what they're saying. Mm-hmm. It's like, we'll give you a lawyer. Just claim you're abandoned. We'll give you a lawyer and you can become
a
citizen.
You'll be a citizen. And that's exactly what the parents want. And that's why they're coming here. Yes. Here. We'll end with this. Baron of Gray Matter, $10 super chat. Last Sunday at the initiative signing, the majority of people I saw in the 2 hours I was there were Gen X boomers. Where are the young folks? You have the kids in school. You will be taxed longer than me. Where? I agree. Although there was some people my age there. I mean, 30s, and I saw some younger couples. But majority, I would say, were over 50.
I think people are checked out. That's why we've got to make sure they're checked back in to what's going on. We got to make sure they're out to vote in November when it's not a presidential election. We got to make sure all of these things happen. So, notice that and then go ask the people around you that are that age
and have them come out and do these things, because you're right on all fronts. They will be taxed the longest. They have more, I guess, to lose in the long term as these policies get worse. All right, Nicole, thank you. We'll get to our closing sanity check coming up next. First, if you want to save some money, because you're not going to save it on taxes or gas or anything, insurance is a great way. You have to have insurance. It's a fact of life. You want to make sure you have good insurance because you've worked hard for everything you have. But you also want to make sure you're not paying for insurance you don't need, or you're not paying too much for the insurance you have. First Mark will handle all that for you. They'll go out, shop the market of carriers for you, come back with their recommendations. Sometimes they might tell you, hey, actually your current coverage is good and we can't find anyone who'll beat it. That's what they told Undivided viewer Carol. And she, thought that was a sign of a very honest company. They basically turned her business away, said, you did a great job with the insurance on your own. But for other people, we've got Undivided viewers saving thousands of dollars a year because they made one phone call to First Mark Insurance to take the First Mark Challenge. You could be our next First Mark Challenge victory story right here on the show. FirstMarkInsurance.com, FirstMarkInsurance.com. There's a reason I trust my insurance, personal and professional, to our friends at First Mark. FirstMarkInsurance.com. And with that, let's get to our closing sanity check. All right. Spencer Pratt did a long sit-down interview with CNN, and I actually didn't know that he considers himself a Republican. Am I late to that game? I kind of assumed.
Well, I think that has said he's more independent. So I don't know that he belongs to the party, but he sees himself more aligned with that party.
Gotcha. So he was asked about why in his interview with CNN.
Why are you a Republican?
Well, when I was a hated reality star.
Yeah.
I got so many death threats. I had so much security and police. And what did they tell me to do? Get a gun. Mm. This is real. I know people don't like guns, but LA was dangerous if you're hated. So I got a gun. My wife got a gun. And then we needed CCWs. Mm. The only people that supported a CCW was the Republican. That was what I aligned with, my safety, my personal safety, my family's safety. I know people don't like guns, but when people are threatening your life and your own security is telling you need to have home protection, train to, it's not like just I went to the, go through the proper steps. I'm also gonna be the mayor that puts LAPD in front of every school to make schools safe, I know people don't like guns, and we need to make everything, especially schools, sure, safe. But that is where I connect to. And it's, and once you feel fear and it's real, you want to protect, yeah, your families.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, some of my reason for going more towards conservatism, a lot of it had to do with public safety. I mean, I've never been a big gun person, but I experienced those issues on a much smaller scale, probably, than he experienced. And when people are trying to make it more difficult for you to protect yourself and your family and your home, while they're making it things less difficult for criminals, that's a wake-up call. All right, that has been our closing sanity check. Don't play me off yet, Nicole. I saw you. She was like, I'm ready. We do not have a show on Monday because it is a holiday, so it is a long weekend. We will have an episode of Sundays with Subscribers. John Carlson, the former KVI host, is joining us to talk about his 2007 battle with the state of Washington when the left came after him in the way they're coming after me, trying to quell my speech. So I wanted to hear what he went through more than 10 years ago or so. 20 years ago. Wow, that's been a while. They were attacking the media then. They're attacking us now. We'll have a new episode of Swamp Watch out. And again, we will not be here on Monday. So have a fantastic weekend. Enjoy the weather. Get out with family and friends. Touch some grass. Take some deep breaths. If you'd like to take advantage of our promo, which is going to be over soon, patreon.com/undivided, patreon.com/undivided. Use the promo code USA30. You get 30% off an entire year. Now you can play me out. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your support of our show. We've been adding so many new paid subscribers in the past week. It's just been fantastic to get that level of support. We do appreciate you. That's about it. That's all I got to say. See you back on the live show Tuesday at noon.